Thank you, Isabel. Nice to be here. So you see, I am good boy. I finally gave a title of my lecture. Now, this will be the entirely combinatorial, or mostly combinatorial talk, but the motivation is stemming from Fourier analysis, and so it leading interesting problems which are easy to state and which are sometimes hard, and so maybe it fits to this description of the good problem what Tim was speaking about. But everything will be easy as opposed to Tim Gower's yesterday lecture. So let's start with this notion. So we work with integers mostly, and a set X, which is subset of Z, which may be finite or infinite, is said to be independent if all the plus minus one linear combination with a finite support are trivial, which are equal to zero as trivial. So you cannot write any element of the as a non-trivial write any expression like that for epsilon I different than zero. So this equivalently means that for any two sets which are different, you the sum will be distinct. Yeah. Now this is sometimes called quasi-independent, because independent is that if these coefficients are not only plus minus one but bigger. But I mean motivated by applications which I am speaking about, I will use this term independent as well to make it short. Now the following is the key notion of this lecture. We say that this set X, this finite or infinite set, has an epsilon property if it has the following finitary description. For every finite subset, we can find an epsilon fraction of the set. So for any subset epsilon, we find subset Z, which is independent and which has at least positive fraction, epsilon fraction of the number of elements of epsilon. And that should hold regardless of the how large this epsilon is. And so it holds for n equal to 1, n equal to 2, and n equal to 3. And a crucial observation is that if you take a finite union of independent set, then this has this union has epsilon property. Yeah. That's easy to see, because this is your X written as a union of these XIs, yeah. And you take any finite subset, so take the largest intersection with it, and it will have it will be independent and will have at least so many points. Now, a quarter of a century ago, actually it's really a quarter of a century, Pizier formulated the following problem. So is it true that for every subset of integers, X has epsilon property if and only if it is a finite union of independence? Yeah. Now this is a special form of the question which was asked Pizier. He asked something more general. I mean, but that was in the context of harmonic analysis. He proved that the condition 1, when formulated for dual group, is equivalent to the Sidon sets. And on other hand side, condition 2 is so far covering all known examples of Sidon sets. And so this led him to this problem. I mean the condition one, that it is equivalent to Sidon sense, is regarded as a major achievement. For example, it was a problem to prove that the union of two Sidon sets is a Sidon set that flows automatically from it. There is a lot of work done. This is more to it than it seems on the first glance, at least for the combinatorist. There is a huge literature on it and profound theorems, and some early work of Bourgain is fundamental in this respect. Now, so this is I think this is a problem which is very nice, and it's fitting to description of the Gauss. It's a hard problem. I will not present the solution of this. That it would start differently the talk if I would be able to present the solution of the problem. It's open, but I will present various variation of it and some indication where perhaps is a difficulty of the problem. And as well, it's related. I think it's a even fundamental problem from the combinatorial setting, because it's leading to some interesting questions and results. So in this lecture, I will show some combinatorial relevance. We speak about the Bézier type problems for various notions of independence, and this is then related to some coloring problems and to Ramsey theory, and it was fitting, the lecture about the Hess-Juve theorem was fitting in this respect, the past lecture. We studied this with Erdős and Redl for some time. Recently, we have no feedback from Erdős, so the progress seems to be somehow a little slower. Yeah, but still, it's interesting. So I start with the two examples, showing that somehow the local version of this Bézier problem is not true. So this fact that you consider these independent sets are defined by the sums or by the conditions which involve arbitrary long summands is essential. So I will show two results. So if the first one is easier, so we say that set X is L, that is some positive integer, L locally independent, if this freeness, this independent condition holds only if you consider at most L summands. And so, for example, for L equal to 2, this is a variation of the P21 sequences. In fact, it's a B21 plus some free. If it would be exactly B21 if L would be, if you would just consider it for I and J equal to 2, not at most 2. And these sets are in the combinatorial number theory as well, called by Sidon. Yeah. Same man, different concept. Yeah. And this leads to a hierarchy of the types of sets, which are called BL1 and BLK hierarchy. And then this is a strict hierarchy which is indecomposable, and being motivated by some of these results about this indecomposability of these BLK sequences, we can prove the following theorem, that the Bézier analogy of Bézier problem for this L independence is not true. So what does it mean that such a such theorem will appear on later sheets as well. So what does it mean, negation of the negative solution of this Bézier problem? So we want to construct a set which has epsilon property, but nevertheless it cannot be partitioned in finitely many parts which would be independent. So XL has, in this case, L minus 1 divided by 2L property for this locally independent set. But moreover, it has to be a finite union of L locally independent sets. It's a But this still has somehow feature that these configurations, which are forbidden, I mean, are finite. Yeah? So on one side you have L sum, and on the other side you have a sum of another L elements, so you have a configuration with two L elements. In PZR, this is unbounded. This is essential feature, but there are you can refine it to result which is actually has an unbounded arity of those forbidden configuration. So you say that X is L independent, L bounded independent, so L independent. If there is no solution, I on one side elements from I, on other side elements from J, two sets, and then on one side there is at most L of them. So, for example, for L equal to 1, it means that you are assuming that no element is a sum of some other elements, arbitrary many. Yeah. And there is a theorem that you can, again, the PZR theorem is not true. Yeah. So there exists a set, XL, which has the epsilon property with respect to this notion of independence, and particularly there is an epsilon property for no sum of other elements. And moreover, the epsilon XL is not a finite union of L independent sets. In this case, the epsilon is much smaller. It's not optimal, but it's of this type. Yeah, so. Now the moral of this is that that the localized version, at least in these two sense, the PZR is not true. And both theorems are proved by set representation or in set version in the same way as you had several times it was mentioned the Heinemann theorem for finite set set union term has is equivalently has a version of the finite union theorem so I mean we equivalently use finite union or we use a reformulation by means of finite sets. So what does it mean then? How does it translate? That there are actually two versions of it. If you have a system of finite set, you say that the set system is L independent. If there are no two sets of indices, left and right, I read, on the left side you have at most L element, such that the union is the union of the these two systems is the same. Now there are two versions of it, stronger and weaker. Either you consider as a multisets this union, or you consider it as a set. I will consider it for the simplicity as the multiset. So beyond. And in this way, you don't need the equivalence between finite sum and like in finite sum and finite union. You are constructing a special set, so you can use the easier way coding these set systems by means of a special set. But there is so these are negative results. So is there any positive result in this direction? Positive results are more somehow sparse, but there is a positive. But there is a here. For example, if you say that M is independent in this sense, if it is L independent for every L, then this PZR holds, at least I'm saying, and this is the following theorem, which is indicated by the proof that if you have a system of a k-tuples, I mean a k is bounded, yeah. And you know that this system of k-tuples has an epsilon property for some epsilon fixed, then M is a union of few in the boundedly many independent sets. And if the problem asks that for our arbitrary but finitely many, you sort of don't care about the dependency between a epsilon and this t. Yeah. And that's sort of easy to prove. You just observe that that independent sets have to have in this. What you assume that all the unions are different, you know. So you code the unions by degrees. Yeah. So all the degrees have to be the same. Have to be different. Pardon. Have to be the different. And there are not so many choices for such a degree. So there have to be the this average degree is bounded. So there exists in the independent set, but the independent set is almost the whole thing. So it means that the average degree in the whole thing has to be bounded, and you can repeatedly use this epsilon property. I mean, you will find one point which has a small degree, you delete it. In the rest, you will find again one point which has small degree because there is a large independent set and so on. And you will find a picture like that, and that you can decompose into finitely many parts. The ones will be in first system, twos will be in the second system, three will be in the second. So in this case, you in the third version has a dispositive solution, but it's very rare, right? It's very rare. Yeah. Well, it will sort of follow from the another view, say from coloring view, and let's say another interpretation of the. So I will present two more interpretations of this Bézier problem: one in by means of a coloring, one means of the in the. Say in the Ramsey setting. Of course, they are all related. This is all the same, all sides of the one thing, one subject. So I mean, in this sense, think of set X as the vertices, set system. M is some set system of sets. Think of it as edges. I mean, set which is subset of X will be set independent if there is no edge there. So if there is no set from M, which is a subset of epsilon. And you can formulate epsilon property on this generality that every subset of X contains independent set of size at least epsilon times epsilon. And then the fact that X is a union of T independent sets is nothing else but what's known as chromatic number of the set system, that it is at most T. And then in this setting, Bézier prototype problem is claiming, or Bézier problem itself is claiming that the epsilon property implies that chromatic number is a finite. I mean, don't worry that actually in the Bézier problem you speak about the countable set. Actually, they use compactness. This is equivalently finite problem. Yeah. So in other words, we are asking something like if the set system has a hereditary large alpha, so in this epsilon sense, epsilon property sense, then better than the chromatic number is bounded. It's interesting, there are such examples. I mean, this was combinatorial studied. I mean, this is related to the graphs which surround so-called perfect graphs. It's as well true for structures which are called matroids. Historically, it's interesting to note that actually the one of the first results in this direction was that it is true for linear dependence, and that was proved by Alfred Horn in 1954. And if you look at his paper, he's writing that this paper is answers a question which was posed to him by K.F. Roth and Richard Rado, so that somehow the stage was set very early. It's a paper from 1954, and it contains that the Bézier, if independence means linearly independent, you work in some vector space, then the Bézier problem has a positive solution. And for matroids, it was proved much later. That's celebrated Edmonds theorem. Yeah. So we back to this abstract or general setting. So motivated by it, we can. Can put if we have a system of k-tuples, we can ask what is the minimum or infimum of this epsilon, so that the epsilon property implies that he is finite for every n. So I mean the finite meaning the pair as a function of epsilon, and we can determine it actually. So that's it's a combination of sort of an old result. The epsilon k is exactly k minus 1 divided by k. Yeah. And that's a negative news. Yeah. So it means that it holds for all epsilon if it is bigger than k minus 1 over k, which is a triviality because there are no edges then. Yeah. So then the chromatic number is move on. If it is smaller than k minus 1, then it is then deeply not true. So that he is unbounded. So we have to, means that in this abstract level, if you don't have any other conditions on M, you don't have much to say. Well, that's actually not true. Yeah. I mean, the lower bound is using the ideas which are implicit in some old work of Erdős and André and it's a shared well-known structure of the shift hypergraphs which can be used for the purpose to showing that he is unbounded for small density. So what about this k minus 1 over k? Yeah. Is there an infimum there or is there a minimum there? Well, it's actually interesting. I mean, for a k equal to 2, it's the 1/2 property implies that chromatic number is at most 2. That's a graph theory, easy theorem. But for none bigger, this is known. For k bigger than 3, this is not clear. And here is a concrete formulation of this problem for k equal to 3. And it's actually surprising to me that such a elementary problem, can be sort of, it wasn't considered, I think, too much. So that can be open. So take a system of triples on the arbitrary set, finite or infinite, and suppose that is a two-set property hole. So it means that if you take any, let's say it again. If you take any subset epsilon, then there exist two sets of elements from epsilon forming set Z, so that Z is independent set. Independent meaning that there is no edge in Z. Yeah. And is it then true that the chromatic number is bounded? And may be bounded by 2. So it's the lower bound is only 2. Yeah, so nothing. But we are almost there, because it's true fractionally. Yeah. So, and I'm somehow not quite clear what this fractional property has to do with it. Yeah. So to define epsilon star, that's usually star meaning fractional, epsilon star property of a system X, M, such that if you take any weight vector for x, you can consider stochastic one, that the sum is 1. That I should actually put it in that formulation immediately. So take some weight of elements, and suppose that for any weight of the elements aw, there exists subset X prime, which is large, let's say, in the sense that the weight of the subset is at least epsilon of the total weight. You obviously suppose that is total weight. Let the total weight be 1. Yeah. And so there exists such a set, and you assume that the set is independent. So I mean, it means that the weight is giving, forcing you that is discrediting some elements or it's propagating some other elements. Of course, the epsilon star property implies implies the normal property. And here's a theorem that that the star to this k minus 1 k, k minus divided by k, star property implies that the chromatic number is equal to at most 2. Yeah. So I mean, if there is no star, it's a problem, it's not clear that it's bounded at all. If there is a star there, this fractional version, then it is then the chromatic number is at most 2. And well, I mean, in this fractional setting, one is usually using some kind of linear programming tools, and I don't think I will go into it, but I have it on the slide, so I just project it. You can read very quickly. And here is the coloring. So that's a coloring of the x1 and the x2. So it's actually a famous technique, this thing. I mean, there was similar things were used by Alan Kleitman when they were solving Hardinger de Brunner conjecture for the piercing numbers for the geometric transversals. So this is in a way standard. Yeah. So. But this fractional, what's called fractional gap, you know. So this fractional gap presently in this situation is actually infinite, right? So that's. I mean, for fractional epsilon, we have two, a chromatic number 2, and for unfractional, it's not even known that it's unbounded. Well, what I should say, let me go back. The star, I mean, the good question is whether what is the difference between this k minus 1 divided by k star property and the property without a star, right? What is are they equivalent, right? And it's well, that we cannot prove, but I mean, in many cases, actually, the unknown star property implies a star property, and that's exactly in the case when, for example, it is in the case then when the structure you are considering, when this set system has many symmetries, when it is, for example, vertex symmetric, and when this independence ratio is monotone. So for the smaller subsystem, it's alpha divided by number of vertices is bigger than alpha divided alpha epsilon divided by epsilon. So there are cases when for example, for Knezer graphs and for highly symmetric structures, I mean the non-star property implies star property, but it's not clear whether. But it holds in general. Ramsey view. Yeah. Well, let's rephrase this fractional two-thirds theorem. Let's rephrase it in particular case in the graphs and triangles. So this is a theorem. Suppose you have a graph G. I'm just rephrasing for this for the special case of the edges and triangles in a graph. And take suppose that for any weight on edges, stochastic weight on edges, there exists a subset of edges which has at least two-thirds of the total weight, two-thirds, and this subset doesn't have a triangle. Then the sets can be partitioned, then the set of edges can be partitioned into two parts so that there is no triangle there. So this is two-thirds star property applied for the three uniform hypergraph on edges of the graph where the three edges form a triangle if and only, form a triple if and only they form a triangle. It's not clear that the two-thirds suffices for it. It's a strange thing, because what this has to do with these triangles, right? What this means, so you take a graph G, and you take the multigraph over G, so you take some of the edges more times. Not necessarily, some of them you take zero times, yeah, so another them. But that's not essential. And you assume that every such a multigraph over G prime has a two set property without a star this time. So you will find always two sets of these multi edges, so there is no triangle. And then you can split, then the theorem is that you can split G and G star into two triangle free graphs. The point is that somehow these multi edges don't, I mean, they, it's irrelevant whether you work in this and this. So. Some other theorems of the one half property of the, in this case, one half property of the graph is not true. That's easy because, I mean, in the graphs, you can always find a bipartite graph which has half of the edges, so it has no triangle, and of course there are graphs which are all triangle by Ramsey theorem, by Ramsey type theorem. So I mean that's here is a formulation for the sum free sets. I mean so which is proved in similar way. I mean one half property if independent means sum free, one half property of X is, doesn't imply that X is a finite union of sum free sets. Two thirds star property of the set implies that X is a union of two sum free sets. And what's between one half plus epsilon, between one half and two thirds, is not clear. We have this fractional theorem we have for hypergraphs for the set system generally, so we can apply it to any system which is considered in Ramsey theory. Here are two more examples: van der Waerden theorem. Yeah. For the three term arithmetic progressions. Suppose you have a set set of natural numbers so that every stochastic weight for every stochastic weight there exists a set which doesn't have contain arithmetic progression of length 3 and it with the weight 2 set. Then you can split it into two sets, so that none of them contains arithmetic progression of length 3. Another example. So that's a variant of what's called Galaibit theorem, geometric theorem. Take a set in the plane. I suppose that for any weight function there exists two set weight subset with weight two set, so that the x prime is in general position, so it doesn't contain three points in the line. Then x can be split into two sets which are in general position. Well, that's on the other hand side, in all these cases, for some very bigger epsilon, of course bigger than two set, the theorem, the Pézier theorem, trivially holds because these forbidden configurations are of bounded size. But maybe. I mean, in these three cases, I mean, of the independence, there was no triangle, there was no arithmetic progression of length 3, there were no three elements. So maybe actually this Pézier time holds for every epsilon, which is smaller than this critical value of the size of the k minus 1 over k, where k is the configuration size. Yeah. So, I mean, then we know that it fractionally holds for k minus 1 over k, but we don't know any smaller value. Maybe for some very tiny value, the Pézier problem holds. So let's formulate it. What does it mean for the arithmetic progression of length 3 in this case? It's written here at the bottom. So I am asking, and it's in a negative form. Okay? I'm asking, does there exist epsilon bigger than 0? and a set, I mean infinite set of integers with the following property. It has epsilon property for not containing, for independence meaning not containing arithmetical progression of the length 3. So for any epsilon finite array exists subset which has epsilon fraction of points of epsilon, and it doesn't contain arithmetical progression of length 3. But moreover, it fails to be a finite union of sets which don't contain arithmetical progression of length 3. So motivated by this, let us formulate this notion to say that set is K van der Waarden if for every finite partition, if the van der Waarden theorem for K-term arithmetic progression holds for the set. So if we partition set X into finitely many parts, we will always find arithmetical progression of in one of the classes. Van der Waarden of course proved that all integers are from van der Waarden set. That's leading to the problem which we could foreshow that it's we all like André Semeredi, so we can as well have an anti-Semeredi problem. Yeah. So what the theorem says, or the problem says, not a theorem, it's open problem. So fix K, and does there exist some epsilon, small epsilon? And does there exist a set X for the K, so that XK has a epsilon property for not containing arithmetical progression of length K? What does it mean? It means that it is deeply non-dense, and the density deeply not true, right? So I mean, it means that the relative density of the set is deeply not true. So if you take any subset, you will find epsilon points which don't contain arithmetical progression of length k. On the other hand side, xk is van der Waarden. And it's sort of really reversing the picture that I mean that you want to prove van der Waarden theorem without actually using any kind of density argument. Well, this such a xk of course doesn't contain a long arithmetical progressions, but that's not obstacle. I mean you may easy by Hills-Jouvet coding, by using Hills-Jouvet theorem, you can code the elements of the combinatorial cubes so that you will not get a long-term arithmetical progression. In fact, you don't get a K plus 1 arithmetical progression. And still, for any partition of infinitely many parts, you get an arithmetical progression of length K. So that's not obstacle. Well, I mean, of course, I mean, by this coding of Hills-Jouvet cubes, you can get very sparse sets, I mean, arbitrary sparse, yeah. But that's not what we are asking. We're asking for the relative density, and this will not work because we have density Hills-Jouvet, even in some elemental proof, as we had just a minute ago. So we cannot this coding cannot be used to disprove such a theorem. And I believe that in a certain sense we are asking for a new proof of van der Waarden theorem. And if you think of it, and maybe I am wrong, but I mean there are not too many proofs, right? So that which of the van der Waarden theorem. There are of course these proofs which follow from density, and some of them use van der Waarden theorem. Yeah. Then there is a Hills-Jouvet proof, and that's basically the only combinatorial proof which is known. I mean, there are other proofs, but the Hills-Jouvet proof is a sort of combinatorial abstraction of all the proofs. So if to prove something like that, or to prove it positively, yeah, I believe that the answer should be positive. There should be such a set, you sort of need to use a different argument than was so far used. And maybe, so let me just last slide. I mean, this is purely speculative slide, you know, that this is really showing that these restricted Ramsey theorems, which were at the end, you know, and these high chromatic sparse graphs, you know, which were in this chromatic part, and the busier type problems, they probably are somehow related, and I think this is not yet well understood. Thank you for your attention.